The next several lessons are quite uplifting. We're not going to be talking about a dark character like Saul in these lessons. In fact, we're talking about Nehemiah in this particular time. Before we go any further with the Nehemiah material, I want to just quickly take a look at the 78th Psalm and read a text that I had penned at the top of my page. It just seems so appropriate for this study.
Which Psalm is that?
The 78th Psalm and the 72nd verse reads so, and this I believe is of course talking about David, so he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. And you can see the two aspects of leadership just summarized very perfectly in that passage, where you see that his guidance from them was from a heart that had a level of integrity. And so from a good heart, he was able to lead the people. I think that would be a good study, a good text also to review again when we begin the next lesson, where Josiah is talked about, and he prepares himself before he begins to prepare the people. And then the second half of that verse, it said he led them by skillful hands. And I think both of these things are essential, that when leaders, it doesn't matter what their backgrounds are, where they come from, ages and so forth, education, that when men come together and have the best interest of the Lord's people at heart, and they serve the Lord with integrity, they're doing what is right because it is right, then whatever, first, they'll get along well and work together, and secondly, whatever they do will be in the best interest of the people. Now we're going to talk about Nehemiah. Nehemiah was one of those heroic figures that almost seems a little bit larger than life. What I note about him is that he is not ashamed like some of the others, or not embarrassed, rather, like some of the others, to talk about what's going on within him. I mean, he is fully and willing to discuss exactly what he thought and what he felt about the occasion. Now, while you will see this sort of thing in the book of Psalms, most of the other prophets, if there is a criticism of their work from the Lord, they report what the Lord had to say about them and didn't talk about what they thought. I think there's an element of wisdom in this as well, that Nehemiah clearly knew what Nehemiah thought and felt at every step along the way. And he connects what he's thinking and what he's feeling along with the choices that he makes and the instructions that he gives the people. So you can sort of see the connection between this man who got his heart right and then from a good heart directs his words and his actions to the people. So I'm not talking about some sort of let's all together get in a counseling mode and so forth, but at least we need to know ourselves and know our hearts, and that might help us better understand why it is we're making the decisions that we make. Now looking at the text, Nehemiah is serving before the king, and he's very, very troubled about the condition of the people of Judah, especially that tiny little ragtag band of Judeans that were left behind whenever Nabonidus came in and took them away, the rest of the people away. Nehemiah is concerned for the broken down condition of the city of Jerusalem. He is made aware of exactly how bad the conditions are there, and it troubles him. And he prays to the Father in heaven. He is not afraid and he's not ashamed to allow the king to see that there's something on his mind. It's not that he's trying to manipulate the king, but this is of critical importance to him. And because it is so important to him, he's not going to hide it from those who are around him. And I think this is also a good matter for leaders. Some of the qualifications that you find of leaders is being grave or being reverent. This reflects the seriousness with which those who are leaders take the responsibility that is laid on them. And it's going to have an impact on their disposition if they have integrity of heart. It's going to have an impact on their disposition, and it's going to be seen and noted by others around them. Sometimes you'll see that elders are a little more sober-minded than and a little less jocular than some of after they become elders than they were before. It's because they see that the care of the church is of such importance to them that it has an impact on them. This doesn't take away from the responsibility of leaders to act in a confident way so that their followers will have trust in them. But it does speak to the fact that they take it seriously. Nehemiah is not afraid to let the king know that he's troubled about this. So he makes his appeal to the king as the chapter, first chapter unfolds. And when you get into the second chapter and fifth verse, he's drawing his request or his explanation to a close. And it's written there, "I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Now, this was almost unprecedented. One of the nice things about the kings in Nehemiah's day, we realize there's been a shift in regime. It's a different regime than the one that was there before. And with the change of regime is a change in policy. Just quickly, when the Assyrians, who were among the first of the great conquerors in that area, when they would conquer a nation, they were like a big ladle. They would stir the whole region. They'd move this people over here, and those people from there in here, and the ones over there out yonder way. They would just shift people around and thus keep them from ever uniting or feeling a sense of belonging and loyalty to the land and so forth. That was their policy. When the Babylonians came in, their policy was that they would make pacts with some of the nations they did not control. They would control as much territory as they could. And then they would use the native peoples in those territories to oversee the Babylonian interests and make pacts with other nations outside. And so that was how they ensured longevity. The Persians were a little bit more forward-thinking. The Persians thought, you know what? Strong, healthy neighbors are a better defense, and we'll save money in terms of the military if we strengthen our neighbors. And so what they began doing was taking some of the persons that were scattered by the Babylonians and before them the Assyrians, and began to gradually encourage them to go back home, to rebuild, to establish an economic base there, even going so far as to help them to reestablish some of their religious practices. And the reason was, happy, productive, healthy neighbors make for a good ally at the frontier. And so that's why they were inclined to do this. This is a testimony of the wisdom of the divine, that these set of circumstances came into place just in time, providentially, for Nehemiah to go back to Jerusalem and begin rebuilding. But even though God created circumstances that would be favorable to the rebuilding, the task before Nehemiah was enormous. It was vast. The first thing he has to do is he's by himself. As a leader, he's taking the initiative. Right now, there's nobody following him. So he's taking the initiative to begin to set up a structure whereby others will see and begin to find something to invest themselves. And by doing that sort of thing, gradually others will come to the work and commit themselves to it. Nehemiah has a very long-term vision here. And he is starting with just one man, himself, and no resources. In fact, you could say that the only resource Nehemiah has is his influence with the king. That's it. But he makes his appeal, and when he's made his appeal to the king, the king's response, well, what do you need? What's it going to take? How long are you going to be gone? How big of a journey is this? What will you need for the trip? And the rest of the account continues to unfold. Nehemiah doesn't spend a lot of time on the journey itself. About verse 11, he comes to Jerusalem. He rests up for 3 days, and then he gets up in the middle of the night. And he only takes a couple of people with him, perhaps a guard or something. He takes a few folks with him, and he begins to walk around the city to see how big the task is, to see how big the job is. And from there, we see the work begin to unfold. Please realize that this man began by himself with no other resource than his influence, and he had this vision of the city being rebuilt, and he went from there. And that's the kind of confidence that leaders in the Lord's church will need to have. Whether the congregation is substantial or small, whether it has a reasonable amount of resources or very few resources, what it's going to take to go from the place of where it is, some cases just holding your own, just holding her own, to take it from where it is and get it to where it's growing and moving forward. What Nehemiah demonstrates to us is that we need to be able to see down the road. Now, this is not just foolish dreaming. This is not just hoping for some pie in the sky or pipe dream of something that will happen. Nehemiah knows that there will be a great deal that needs to be done along the way. But Nehemiah sees long term down the road. And when he sees down the road, he's able then to see all of the steps that it's going to take to get there. One of the things I do when I take hikes is I have an app on my phone that tells me exactly where I am. And as I walk, and I watch that app, there's a little line, there's an arrow and a little line that begins to show how far I've come. So as I look at that and I see the goal or the destination up here and the starting point down here, I can see the progress that I've made along the trail. And then I can see the trail that's left, how much I have left, and the key down in the corner tells me how far it is. So what I have the vision of being here, but I also know that I've got all of this to do in between. Because Nehemiah had a clear vision of where he wanted the people to be and the city to be, he was then enabled to see step by step what would be necessary along the way. Another characteristic of Nehemiah that he demonstrates is that he has the absolute confidence that God is going to help him with each of these steps along the way. And it becomes evident as the account unfolds. All right. Wow, that was a long introduction. In the first full paragraph, he says, men are often limited in what they accomplish in God's kingdom because they do not see what might be accomplished. They try to find reasons why something can't be done rather than what can be. If we are measuring what can be done based upon what resources we presently have, if we are measuring what can be done based upon what has been accomplished in the past, we are imposing what on our outcome? Absolutely. We are imposing limitations on not only the outcome, but on the process to get there. I'm not talking about thinking outside the box of Scripture to accomplish these things, but not to consider any of the other things that most folks would say, well, that's a limitation. Well, you're not going to be able to get beyond this barrier. Nehemiah started without a single coin. All he started with was his influence with the king. And from there, it began to grow. There were a number of reasons why it would never be accomplished, and I don't want to jump ahead too fast. But here's what Nehemiah had to overcome in order to start the initiative. In the first, after the first paragraph, he's got a question. What do you see in Nehemiah's statement above that shows a different attitude, perhaps a different attitude than what is commonly seen among those who do not believe in moving, that one can move forward?
What jumps out at me with that is he tells the king he wants to go there that I might rebuild it. This is just insurmountable thinking. I'm going to go rebuild a city, you know, with God's help. But that's a Herculean goal.
Yes, it is.
But he had the confidence he could do that. And that's just an amazing thing to start with.
Like Abraham, by faith, he's going to a place he'd never been to before, but
he had the faith and the confidence that God would see to it that whatever was between here and me being in that place, God would take care of. And I think that's key. Now, let's make an application. Ourselves, let's imagine that we are a Nehemiah and we have a congregation of 45 people and no biblically arranged leadership. What goal do we have? Long-term goal, a stable eldership with others preparing to become elders when those reach the limit of their lifespan. A building that is filled, thinking about possibly expanding somehow. Have a vision and have a goal. How do you get there with a congregation of 45 people, most of them, pardon the way this sounds, over the age of 50? How do you get there with a congregation like that and no elders and deacons? Some folks are simply going to have to say, this is where we want to be. That's our vision. That's where we want to be. And clearly and cohesively agree on that vision. And it will come to us what needs to be done along the way. What resources we have right now. You know why congregations often fail? And I'm not talking about Trail of Coochie at this time. Why congregations often fail in appointing elders? Because when the evangelist says, I want to preach on the elders, it would be good to have elders. We don't have anybody qualified. They immediately go right there. Well, in the first place, my response would be, how well have you studied the eldership to know whether you have anyone qualified? And second, have you spoken to the others who might be to determine from the text whether they are or not? The answer is going to be no. They immediately go to the place where we don't have the resources. So what they do is assume that the only resources they have is just, as I've been told so many times, to keep the doors open in this community. That is not a goal for a congregation. I don't care how small it is or how quickly it's been in decline. That is not a reasonable goal for a local congregation, just keeping the doors open. Just keeping the lights on so that we can have worship services. That's not a goal. That's hiding in the basement. Instead, have a vision and know that maybe the treasury is not very big. Maybe the member base is small and limited. Maybe folks are aged and limited in their capacity. You have some place to start. The rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem began with one man with a vision. That's where it started. And the building of any congregation is often going to have to begin with a few disciples who have a clear vision of where the church needs to go. And not just keeping the doors open. Nehemiah said, when you put emphasis on the word I, that's why I started shaking my head, because Nehemiah realized that it starts with him. I want to go back and build the city of Jerusalem. I want to do this good work. So that was the first hurdle that he overcame. Who's going to do this work? You probably remember from grade school the story of the little red hen I see head shaking. Okay. The little red hen, who's going to do it? Nobody wanted to do it but the little red hen. We're going to have to be little red hens and just step forward and say, we're going to do this work. Nehemiah's attitude differed because he took the risk to ask a king to implement a policy in transition. He has no immediate resources. He has no plans. In fact, he has no protection. Nehemiah has no one at this point to go with him on the trip to Jerusalem, let alone to start building the city. He has a monumental reconstruction ahead of him. But what made it possible was that Nehemiah saw what others did not see. At the bottom of that paragraph, I highlighted he had a vision of what should be done and what could be done. Quite often, those two are the same. Sometimes they will not be. And realistically speaking, those times when they will not be is when our vision interferes with the work of the Lord or the will of the Lord. So our vision needs to be in keeping with what God's vision for a local church is, and our vision also needs to be applied within the parameters of what the Scriptures define. So what should be and what could be done. Okay, here's where we come into the difficulty. There were thousands of Jews who lived in Jerusalem. When Nebuchadnezzar's general Nabonidus came in and cleaned out the countryside, he left behind a lot of Jews. He didn't take everyone back with him. More often than not, those generals would take back the best of the folks who were there and leave behind those who were not artisans and leave behind those who were not metal workers, but those who were simple agrarian farmers and with very few land holdings. People who could not pull together and form a threat to them should they return. So that's what's left behind in Jerusalem. People with few resources and little, if any, experience in leadership. So the question is, why haven't they rebuilt the walls? Why didn't they rebuild them? What kind of excuses could they have offered? He said list three. I've got more than that. But what are some of the excuses that the people in Jerusalem could have offered for not rebuilding the walls during that 70 years of captivity?
We aren't strong enough. You know, we don't have the resources.
There are too few of us. We don't have enough money. What else?
Our leaders aren't leading and they're not inspiring us.
Yeah, leaders are still, what few leaders we have are corrupt. There were enemies and squatters all around them. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem had encroached on Judean property and Judean landholdings. And, pardon? Yes, they had intermarried with their neighbors, which reduces the impetus and drive to go ahead and restore the nation as it once was. All kinds of reasons. It just was a big task, and the people didn't have a leader. And that's the one that heads my list. It is not that the people were lazy. It's not that they didn't know that the city needed to be rebuilt. And this is something that must be accepted by those who will be leaders. And that is that not everyone has that capacity. Not everyone has within them the ability or the gift of being a leader. That's why when Paul explained to the Ephesian disciples in chapter 4, speaking of Jesus, he gave some to be apostles and prophets and pastors and teachers. Do you see the point? Different ones have different abilities. Not everyone is given the capacity to be a leader. Everyone is given the capacity to follow good leadership, but not everyone has the capacity to be a leader. So that was the problem. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 14. In Proverbs 11 and 14, Solomon says something there with regard to quality leadership or the effect of good leadership. Notice what he says in 14. Where there is no counsel, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. There are those who need instruction and guidance from others in order to avoid either falling or to get back up once they've fallen. The 29th chapter and the 4th verse, the king establishes the land by justice. He has an alternative there, a bad behavior. But his point is the king brings order to the land. In Jerusalem, there were a number of people who were Jewish in their background, but they had no one to bring order to them and structure to their desire to rebuild the city. In a local congregation, there are only going to be a few who are qualified and capable of serving as elders. Not all the men will become elders, some because they have failed to qualify themselves, and others because they simply don't have the capacity to lead, and that's acceptable. There are other tasks and responsibilities for them. With regard to Nehemiah, do you think Nehemiah was a realist when he decided to go to Jerusalem? Now, that one might be subject to the opinion of observers, but what would you say in the context of the study? He was a realist, perhaps in what sense, or not a realist?
He was a realist that he had faith in God that he could do it.
Yeah.
If he was trying to do this on his own, he wouldn't be a realist.
Okay. What did he have to believe?
That he would have God's backing in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a very good point, and I agree with that. But before he has to believe that he has God's backing to do this job, once he undertakes it, what must he believe before that? That God wants this job done. That God wants Jerusalem restored. Well, it has been part of prophecy down through the generations, and Nehemiah, as a fluent man and a well-read man, would know this. He would know this, that it was God's will that the Messiah come from Judea in Jerusalem specifically, where he would begin his leadership, that he would be born in Bethlehem, a city of Judea. This place needs to be restored and rebuilt so the Messiah can come. It is God's will that we rebuild Jerusalem. How do we apply that in the local church? It is God's will that the congregation have elders. It is God's will that the local congregation grow and increase in its influence in the community. So the first thing that leaders in the local church need to do is believe that it is God's will that the church have leaders. Conversely, what is not God's will with regard to a local church? It is not God's will that local churches, for whatever reason that may be, they may have, it is not God's will that they maintain a business meeting system in perpetuity. It is not God's will that the local congregation be content with just holding on to the members that they have. It's God's will that the local church have scriptural leadership and move forward and grow. So in order to be leaders, kingdom leaders, that has to be our first conviction. Our second conviction will be, since it is God's will that this take place, it only makes sense that God's going to help us do that. And it becomes easier to believe than that God's going to help us each step along the way. A Christian realist, and I have in my notes here, counts the help of God as the primary resource. Okay. His next point, jokingly, people sometimes say you can't get there from here. While that may be said as a joke, some people live their lives with that defeatist attitude. The positive title above displays a much better attitude, but is success merely a matter of attitude? If not, what critical thing is needed to reach the destination? Attitude is never going to be enough. So what critical thing is needed beyond having attitude?
Doing it.
A will to engage it. The will. Attitude gives us the right spirit toward it. Will is the spirit put into motion, put into action. So after the attitude that God wants this church to grow, God wants this church to have leadership, that's His will. It's now my will because it's God's will. That's my attitude. My will then becomes my spirit, the attitude toward it, put into motion or put into action. Nehemiah had an attitude that Jerusalem needed built, but it wasn't going to take place until Nehemiah steps out of his comfort zone and says to the king, "Yes, my face is sad, but it's sad because Jerusalem is in ruins, and I'd like to go back and rebuild it." That was Nehemiah's attitude in motion. We sometimes say that when children act up, they're giving us attitude. No, they're not. They're exercising their will. Their attitude is what gave them permission to act up in the first place. We see this applied when it comes to leadership in a local church. They can have the attitude and the desire for the church to grow, but it does not begin until they exercise that spirit or exercise that attitude with their will. And the will needs to be strong and persistent as well. The next section is Nehemiah saw what others did not see. I have highlighted under number one, his confidence in God and believing in his help put power in his plan to rebuild the wall. It enabled him to take risks and to do things that for which there was no certain outcome, but because he had faith in God, because he had confidence in God, those risks that he took were successful. I mentioned that he took the risk of talking to a powerful king. That's one risk. The second risk he took was taking the journey with provisions from the king to go back there and begin. I mean, even though it may not have been a vast sum in our estimation, by today's corporate standards, in those days it would be an enormous sum of money. And they could have been interrupted by any number of marauders along the way on that journey back. Nehemiah has to have confidence that God's going to carry them safely there with the resources and the permissions from the king to do that work. Then Nehemiah has to have the confidence that when he arrives there, he'll be able to see what needs to be done and they'll be able to figure out the work and how it is to be accomplished. That there will be people there to do the task. That there will be resources. You know, part of the military, they say, what is a military marches on what? It marches on its stomach. Then, in other words, they talk about how important the supply lines are. Nehemiah did not know when he got to Jerusalem whether there would be large resources of goods to take the farmers out of the fields and put trowels in their hand for laying brick. Do they have enough resources there for us to be able to say, okay, let's just have a few farmers out there, the rest of you come and get hammers and axes? He didn't know these things. Each of these things was a risk, but he had to have the confidence that God, because it was God's will that the city be rebuilt, that God was going to supply those things that would accomplish the task, that they would come in time as they made each step along the way. He had a distant vision, that is, he could see afar off. He saw Jerusalem's place in God's plan for the future coming Messiah. He knew how important it was, and because he had this vision, he drove toward it. And it was an early vision. Last part of that paragraph, they were convinced they could rebuild the wall, but only after Nehemiah showed them that they could do it. He had to take his vision and then excite or to encourage the others to share the same vision. So how would he accomplish this? I think he would begin by telling them, it is the Lord's will that this city be rebuilt. And evidence that it is the Lord's will is the king back in Persia sent me with letters of authority. And the king back in Persia sent supplies to help begin the work. People think, oh, God must be with us in this. Yes, and he'll say, and look how the Lord preserved me on that journey all the way back here to Jerusalem. Oh my, the Lord is really with you. And here's my plans for rebuilding the city. Suddenly he has shown them a few things that God has done, and he has instilled his vision in them. and they're ready to begin building. The application for a local congregation is similar. Once we have a vision of where the church needs to go, we then make it a point that this is God's vision, not our vision. It is God's vision, and therefore we are adopting it. And he's helped us to this point. Let's be confident that he will help us each step along the way. No, we don't know what's going to happen next month. But if we're doing what God wants us to do this month to get to next month, he'll supply us what we need then.
And once that work starts, and people are encouraged with that, there starts an excitement.
Momentum.
And this can build, and that adds to more excitement. And when work gets done, and it can be a expanding growth that can't, but it has to get that initial ball rolling for this to develop.
Yeah, that's what this lesson is all about. It's about starting from absolutely nothing, which was where Jerusalem was before Nehemiah heard about its condition. Starting from absolutely nothing to where the city's walls are being built. And it's a threat to the encroaching neighbors. There was a lot of steps in between. But because Nehemiah got excited and began working, he was able to encourage others as well. In fact, there will be some moral things, if you continue to read the book, some moral things that changes that he encourages in them that further fuels their zeal in getting the city finished and the temple started. Okay. The next section is begin with the end in mind. And most of that is pretty simple. He refers to the past. He refers to the Cheshire Cat, which I'm a Lewis Carroll fan, but that one was tedious. If you aim at nothing, you are sure to hit it. That's a very good point. There's another way of saying this. If you aim for the sun, you might only get to the moon, but if you aim for the moon, you might fall short. That is, choose a very high and worthy goal. And that's just begin with an end in mind. Nehemiah began with the end in mind, but he also, because of that, was able to see that there would be several steps along the way. He didn't get impatient. He just decided to face each one as they came. If we sit back and consider how big a task it is that we have ahead of ourselves, what's going to happen is that discouragement's going to set in, because we'll begin thinking about all the things that we don't have between here and there, and all of the things that have happened in the past to prevent this or interfere with this. Instead, focus on the goal. And know that we're going to have to take these steps one at a time and take our time to get to that goal. The next section is entitled, The King's Cupbearer Becomes the King's Construction Leader. I hope that you had some time to fill in the answers. I want to go through these, and then I want to look at the closing before we run out of time. Before Nehemiah saw anything else, he first saw what? What was the first thing that he saw?
The problem.
Yes, the problem. He saw the extent of the problem, and therefore, in seeing the size of the problem, he saw the magnitude or the intensity with which the problem needed to be addressed. The next question, because Nehemiah was a man of faith, he saw the need for what?
Action.
Okay, action. But he, in that section, if you read, he's praying to God. So he sees the need. The first action, I guess, that you could say that he took was to invoke God's help. He appeals to the Lord for help.
You know, I thought in chapter 2 there, where when Artaxerxes says, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. What would you request?
Just a minute, King.
Yeah, I think, what did he pray for? Like, thank you for answering my prayer, Lord. Please give me the strength to word this in the right way, what my needs are, so
yeah.
I can enlist his help. And, you know, I just thought that was an interesting aside. You know,
it would be neat to know what it was that he prayed for. Be helpful for us as well. But, yeah, invoking God's help, critical. And it's neat that he prays to God for help when the king asks him a question. Number two, because he saw the size of the task, he saw the need for what? In 1 through 9. And we've already talked about God's help. What did he see the need for? In that section, the king's blessing and resources. He needed authority for the king to do something like this. He needed the king's permission and the resources of the empire. The next section, verses 8 and 18. Through this endeavor, Nehemiah saw this upon him. What did he see on him? It's stated twice. He saw God's hand on him. He saw God's hand on him. God was involved. And I know that we're uncomfortable with doing this, and I refrain from it myself for the same reason, because it sounds so much like denominational testifying, where persons, well, the Lord helped me do this, or the Lord helped me do that. I think that it is a clearly scriptural practice for God's people to see that when their efforts on his behalf are facilitated, it was God helping them, and thank him for it. Nehemiah says twice, I saw the hand of the Lord with me. This won't be the only time that he says this in this book. He'll say it again. And it's not the only time that we see an Old Testament carrier talk, or Old Testament prophet talk about God carrying them or his hand being upon them in a given activity. And the Apostle Paul also spoke about this on two occasions. So it is a biblical principle to see and thank God for those times that he has helped us to do the works he has given us. Upon arriving in Jerusalem, he saw the need to do what?
Assess the situation.
Yeah, we've got to take a look at this. He rests a few days and he gives an assessment of what the city needs. Chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, Nehemiah saw the need to cast his what before the Jewish leaders? He's putting his plans and his purposes, put his purpose, his vision before the Jewish leader and his plans to accomplish them. 2 and 18, Nehemiah saw the need to get what from Jewish officials in Jerusalem? He would need their cooperation. He would need their help. Now, he's already had to persuade one powerful group of leaders at that end of the spectrum, all the way back in the Persian capital. Now, he's having to persuade the people themselves, or the leaders of the people in the place. Simply because the king gave him permission to go and do this doesn't mean that he's going to be successful with the people he's to work with. That's a difficult lesson for those who would be leaders in a local congregation. Just because the Lord has authorized that they have elders, and just because men are qualified to serve as elders, doesn't mean that they're going to receive the cooperation from the disciples immediately. That's not a given. It's something that is worked toward, but it's not a given. And the third one, the third chapter, he sees the need to do what? To gather and commission the people and get them involved, get them working together. Go over to the third chapter of Nehemiah for just a minute. If you were to read the third chapter of Nehemiah, it would read like a work order. Yeah, just like a work order. This is what each one of them does. You know, next to Eliashib, the men of Jericho built, and next to them Zachar, the son of Imri, built. And you see, and next to them built, and next to them built, and so forth, all the way through the chapter. What I see the overriding message here is that within a couple of chapters, Nehemiah has the people inspired to work, and not just to work, but to work together. Elbow to elbow, they're each working on their section of wall. If you read this account, there was a man who had no sons, so he brought his daughters to work and gave them trowels, and they began laying brick with him. There was one fellow who had He and his family had completed their section of wall, and they went back to what we would call the foreman and said, hey, we need some more work. So they gave him a section of wall over by the priests to work on. It is amazing to see the people fired up with enthusiasm in getting to work. I don't have any sons, but I'm going to bring my daughters to lay bricks. I'm done with my section of wall. Do you have any more wall for me to fix? You got to love that. And all of them working right next to one another in a row around the walls of the city of Jerusalem. A very encouraging account. This is what happened when Nehemiah was able to successfully communicate his vision to the people, and they made it their vision as well. He asked the question, I think it's rather obvious, do you think it's possible for us to learn these things? Absolutely. In every leadership endeavor we're engaged in, whether it be in our homes, as leaders in our homes, in the workplace, in the community, and especially in the Lord's church, that these same principles will apply. Have a vision of where the Lord's work is to go, where it needs to be. Make sure that that vision is the Lord's will. Make that your own will. See long term what will be and the steps along the way. Patiently engage those steps and trust the Lord for the resources along the way. It will inspire others to get on board and to work together for the fulfillment of this vision. He closes by saying Nehemiah saw what others did not see and knew how to get there from here. From the 8 qualities in the exercise above, list 2 qualities where you think you need to particularly improve your vision. Don't answer those out loud. That is for your benefit. But I put down to be able to see the help that others are capable of. Nehemiah saw something in that ragtag bunch of Jews that were left in the city to organize a work party that rebuilt the walls in a short period of time. He was able to see in others what they were capable of. And that would be a helpful vision to have. And that is a second one I put, is to see all the way to the end and not just the beginning or the steps along the way. Is there any discussion on this before we close our class?
This was so encouraging to me that we could apply it to our congregation. That's
the whole point of these studies. Long term, what we're trying to accomplish here is to develop the spirit of those who would lead in a congregation. Our studies that we're going to begin, hopefully on Sundays, eventually, will be in the matter of scriptural organization and leaders in the church. And then from there, the next step is to begin the process of looking out among ourselves. It's about moving forward step by step. We can have a long-term vision. My point is that it's got to start somewhere. With Nehemiah, he was one man. One man is not really going to be enough here, especially somebody who's a northerner, a transplant, so to speak. It's okay for me to have a vision for the congregation, but that's going to take those who are well-respected in the congregation to have the same vision and press in the same direction.
Another thing I'm impressed with is, mentioned this recently, how God can take if he could take Gideon from where he was to what he became, and if he can take Moses, this keeps coming to mind. When Moses is coming down back out of the mountain with the law, and he sees the people have turned into idolatry, it's God's wrath, says, "Get back, I'm going to destroy the people. I'll start over with you." God can take individuals and move them to where, if they're willing to, people can be transformed.
It's exactly the case. Look at what a transformation took place in the spoiled Joseph. He was sort of a spoiled rich kid, And he is transformed by his experiences to where God uses him not only to save the children of Israel, but to preserve the Egyptians until Israel is ready to leave. God's capable of taking men and women in what we would consider a hopeless condition and by his providence transform them. And that's what we need to believe can take place here.